Chapter 6. Al Lathrop was still thumbing through his textbook samples and pretending he was too busy to talk to me when the intercom on Miss Marble's desk buzzed, and she smiled at me as if we had a great and sexy secret.
You can go in now, Charlie.
I got up. Sell those textbooks, Al.
He gave me a quick, nervous, insincere smile.
I sure will, Charlie. I went through the slatted gate, past the big safe set into the wall on the right, and Miss Marble's cluttered desk on the left. Straight ahead was a door with a frosted glass pane. Thomas Denver, principal, was lettered on the glass. I walked in. Mr. Denver was looking at the bugle, the school rag. He was a tall, cadaverous man who looked something like John Carradine. He was bald and skinny. His hands were long and full of knuckles. His tie was pulled down and the top button of his shirt was undone. The skin on his throat looked grizzled and irritated from overshaving. Sit down, Charlie. I sat down and folded my hands. I'm a great old hand folder. It's a trick I picked up from my father. Through the window behind Mr. Denver, I could see the lawn, but not the fearless way it grew right up to the building. I was too high, and it was too bad. It might have helped, like a nightlight when you are small. Mr. Denver put the bugle down and leaned back in his chair. Kind of hard to see that way, isn't it? He grunted. Mr. Denver was a crackerjack grunter. If there was a national grunting bee, I would put all my money on Mr. Denver. I brushed my hair away from my eyes. There was a picture of Mr. Denver's family on his desk, which was even more cluttered than Miss Marble's. The family looked well-fed and well-adjusted. His wife was sort of porky, but the two kids were as cute as buttons and didn't look a bit like John Carradine. Two little girls, both blonde. Don Grace has finished his report, and I've had it since last Thursday, considering his conclusions and his recommendations as carefully as I can. We all appreciate the seriousness of this matter, and I've taken the liberty of discussing the whole thing with John Carlson also. So our huge, slimy, and mindless, stumbling around in the stinking swamp of my subconscious, never finding a tar pit big enough to hold it. But that's me. And I started to tell you about them, those bright college-bound students that, metaphorically speaking, walked down to the store to get milk and ended up in the middle of an armed robbery. I'm a documented case, routine grist for the newspaper mill. 1,000 newsboys hawked me on 1,000 street corners. I had 50 seconds on Chancellor Brinkley and a column and a half in Time. And I stand here before you, metaphorically speaking, again, and tell you I'm perfectly sane. I do have one slightly crooked wheel upstairs, but everything else is ticking along just 4-0, thank you very much. So, them. How do you understand them? We have to discuss that, don't we? Do you have an office pass, Mr. Decker? She asked me. Yes, I said, and took the pistol out of my belt. I wasn't even sure it was loaded until it went off. I shot her in the head. Mrs. Underwood never knew what hit her, I'm sure. She fell sideways onto her desk and then rolled onto the floor, and that expectant expression never left her face. I'm the sane one. I'm the croupier. I'm the guy who spins the ball against the spin of the wheel. The guy who lays his money on odd even. The girl who lays her money on black red. What about them? There isn't any division of time to express the marrow of our lives. The time between the explosion of lead from the muzzle and the meat impact. Between the impact and the darkness. There's only barren instant replay that shows nothing new. I shot her, she fell, and there was an indescribable moment of silence, an infinite duration of time, and we all stepped back, watching the ball go around and around, ticking, bouncing, lighting for an instant, going on, heads and tails, red and black, odd and even. I think that moment ended, I really do. But sometimes in the dark, I think that hideous, random moment is still going on, that the wheel is even yet in spin, and I dreamed all the rest. What must it be like for a suicide coming down from a high ledge? I'm sure it must be a very sane feeling. That's probably why they scream all the way down.